This is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the art of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
Joining me this week is a globally known HR thought leader who's been dubbed the Michael Jordan of hiring. He's written thousands of articles and several books covering all areas of talent management. His name is Dr. John Sullivan. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's so great to meet you. I think I started reading about you in the 80s when I got into the world, and you were contributing a lot, I think, at that time to the Fordyce letter.
ERE and the Fordyce, too, yeah.
Uh-huh, yep. So used to get all those in the mail.
Mail?
Yeah, I know. Remember the mail?
Yeah.
I thought it would be a great place to start out. You know, you've been in talent management and HR for a long time, but I'm kind of curious, how did you get started?
Well, my claim to fame is I'm a business guy. So I got my MBA and I got a call from an auto dealership in the South. And they said, John, could you help us hire better salespeople? Well, sales is the best place to be in recruiting, because when you hire a good salesperson, you can tell by their sales go up. So I came in and they said, well, we should hire engineers with suits, know about the big ass motor. And I go, well, how do you know that's what your customers want? He says, because I own this business, and shut up, kid. And so I said, no, we got to talk to some people who bought the product. So we call them post-ex interviews now, but quite effective. So it turns out that they liked the engineer. Back then was a male who would talk about the big motor and the specs. But the other top salespeople were country folk. They literally wore overalls and kind of chewed a piece of straw in their mouth. And so I said, what about these people? Well, they're just hicks. But it turns out they sold just as much as the engineers, because it turns out, and through the post-exit interviews, we learned people don't want to be gypped in a car deal. And they thought these people were just dummies and they couldn't be cheating them. And so they were bought just as many cars. So that's where I learned where data matters. And that was 40 years ago, is that you can't assume you know. Most people do assume they know. But it turns out that, yeah, engineers can sell cars to males who care about the big motor. But there are just as many people that don't want to get gypped. And you better have salespeople with country feeling that they're not going to take advantage of you.
Mm-hmm. Gets back to culture, right?
Well, it's customer attraction factor. So you have to know why people are attracted. And most companies don't. They guess that why people are attracted. They assume it's the money. But it's usually, actually, the number one factor is the work making a difference. Most people want to do work that they are excited, don't want to put it down, and then they want to make it work that's going to make a difference, you know, make people's lives better, save the environment, something like that. So if you put money first, you'll get the wrong people, and you'll miss the ones that want to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. So from the auto dealership experience, then, you know, how did you end up in the Bay Area?
Well, one, I was in Florida. Everybody thought I was crazy and said, you need to go to California. And then I started reading about how HP was they played volleyball at lunch. That just is not possible in the corporate business world. So I just wanted to go, and sure enough, I ended up working for HP eventually. But I just moved because they experiment, they try crazy things. And then I did a case study on Apple, Google, and Facebook, the three most valuable companies, and found that, boy, they do everything totally different, especially Google with data. And so I've continued with that approach. Is most people in recruiting don't use data, but data will set you free. And there's a strata. So maybe women want childcare, but men want more vacation time. And so you have to personalize your recruiting advertising, your branding. Data tells you what exactly they want. And I recommend that recruiters ask a simple question. Kathleen, what's it going to take to get you into this job? And then ask you to list your decision factors. Well, I'm not going to commute. I want to work at home. And once I know those, I can sculpt my sales approach to you. So that's the marketing approach. So one of the future of, or the past should be, is that this is marketing research. You have to know the candidate. Unfortunately, they're not all alike. And if you stereotype or guess, like diversity, you can't assume Indian Asians are the same as Chinese Asians. So it takes a strata or a sample of more personalized approach. And most people, when you ask them the attraction factors, they're just wrong by at least 50%, sometimes 75%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting you talk about data, because that is a big piece of the recruitment research process. And we talk about the importance of capturing the market data, and ours is anecdotal, but it really does help the hiring leader to understand what the landscape looks like so that they know, what they need to do to attract these individuals to their organizations.
Well, I find that many managers are arrogant, if I can be polite. I know what I want.
Mm-hmm.
I want grade point average. I want them to go to in the Navy because I was in the Navy. They just come up with this stupid stuff. There are predictive factors, things that predict success. So we used to think it was grades or that great school you went to. It just turns out that's not true. And so it's really hard to get managers, even experience. Turns out, if you're in a world that changes overnight, experience has no value. And after the pandemic, most behavioral interview questions are worthless because the answer has changed. We wouldn't do it that way anymore. No, we wouldn't show up at the front door. And so you just have to be ready for that. And most hiring managers are not. And they've been given so much power, they can say, I want someone who's been in the Navy. And it's like, no, that most women haven't been in the Navy. If you're gay, you probably haven't been in the Navy. And
mm-hmm.
you can still do the job. And
mm-hmm.
so you have to be really careful with the power we've given to hiring managers, because they use their gut. They don't use data.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Well, in preparing for our conversation today, I reached out to a few of my recruiters and told them that I was having this conversation, and several of them sent me some questions that they would, we follow your articles and whatnot. And so I have a few questions from them. And one of your recent articles, it's the one that's spend more, not less on cost per hire, and instead focus on hiring results.
Yes.
And so again, you're recommending to companies that they focus less on that cost per hire and more on the results. So how do you deliver this message to companies that you work with so that they really understand that bigger picture from the beginning?
Well, first of all, I don't recommend they pay less attention. I recommend they don't do it because it's so distracting. It's so powerful. Accountants do costs, but this is the strategic function. So we know that CEOs routinely for the last 7 years, actually in one study, have said their number one issue is talent management. And I know several that have told me, I need all this talent regardless of cost.
Mm-hmm.
So you're countering it, and you're focusing on the non-strategic things. So if you're going to hire a brain surgeon or a pilot, you don't ask them to, hey, buy the cheap instruments. So you want to focus on the money. So here's my example. If you take Apple, the average employee at Apple earns $1.8 million every year. Incredible amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
The average cost for hire is $4,000. Relatively speaking, it's insignificant compared to if you hire someone who performs not just one time the $1.8 million, but 10 times. So Apple has calculated a top performer produces 10 times. So that essentially means a top performer at Apple literally produces $18 billion every year. $4,000 is chump change. So when you hire LeBron, you don't complain about how big his steak was, what motel he wants to live in. It's just distracting. You're trying to hire a superstar. The amount they're going to bring is so much that the cost is just irrelevant. So I use revenue per employee, ROI, and say, okay, whatever cost item is going to make a big difference, but even the salary is minuscule. If you bring in $18 million a year, your salary is probably not going to be that high.
Do you see then it's not really the CEO or the CFO that you have to help understand this? It's really more the recruiters and the HR professionals that are struggling with the dollars that they're spending?
Oh, definitely. CFOs know immediately. They do ROI. They live off of ROI. ROI is return money you get back compared to cost. But we only look at the cost part. We don't look
mm-hmm.
at the return. We don't calculate the return. So my approach to recruiting, I call it business impact recruiting. It's how do you increase the business impact, the revenue, whatever you're trying to do, the innovation, as a result of great hiring. And obviously, if you hire LeBron, you're going to win war games. And so we fail to measure the results of hiring, which is we hire people that perform at a higher level. And so a lot of people call that quality of hire. But it scares the crap out of HR people. I don't know why the world has been measuring Six Sigma for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you measure the performance of the people you hire. They perform better this year than last year. Hires, you've made a great hire. And you look at the business impact. So I recommend you start in sales. It's so easy. If you hire a great salesperson, they say produce $1 million a year. But if you hire a super salesperson, they produce three. So after you hire someone, all you have to do is check their sales. Really not that hard, but HR people for some reason resist it. So start in sales and move to marketing or product development. But it's pretty easy to show that good sourcing, great recruiters, great everything will produce someone who not only produces the average at Apple at 1.8, but maybe 2.8 or 10 times that. So that's what I try to do. And if when I'm at Apple, I just say, I'm going to hire you another Steve Jobs. Do you care what it costs? Mm-hmm. And they just laugh. Why would you mm-hmm. care?
Yeah. So you're educating our future HR leaders, right, over there?
Yes.
How are you teaching them or helping them understand this? Because I think it's huge, and it is going to make a huge impact moving into the future.
Well, I'm lucky in that university students that I have are all business majors. To me, the problem with recruiting is these are not business people. They're salespeople, they're relationship people, there are lots of things. They're not business people. So when you ask business people what they do, business impact's the first thing that comes up. How do I show I'm making a difference? One, because I just want to know, but two, so that I don't get my budget cut. So when you teach business students who are revolutionaries, they think everything, they call me granddad. It's like everything they want to do different. And so since I think, or I know, recruiting is a field where we need to do 75% of the things different, then they're just more open to it. They expect it. And when they hear that Google doesn't use grades, even though they have grades, they go, grades are silly. If you're a single mom with three kids taking classes at night, working, of course your grade is going to be lower. Doesn't mean you're going to be lower. And so grades, school, all that stuff, even experience, turns out in the world it changes rapidly. Experience doesn't predict very well. So they're open to more, and as business students, just more data-driven. HR and recruiting is the only field that has not become data-driven. Finance, marketing, product development, everything else is data-driven.
So let's talk about the unicorn recruiting function. And so you define it as the rare recruiting function that is no longer facing a talent shortage. They build a competitive advantage by using outside-the-box recruiting tools. And one of the strategies that you recommend is revisiting candidates that came close. And I love how you coined them the silver medalist. Mm-hmm. What's your advice to hiring leaders as they're re-engaging with this hiring pool that they passed on previously? How should they do that? They normally are going to be a little apprehensive, right?
Well, no, because you mentioned the bad first step. You don't let them go. You keep in touch with them. You go, hey, you were up for this, you know, golf opening, and Tiger Woods was ahead of you. Of course you lost. But if Tiger didn't apply in a month for the same job, you would have gotten it. So we build a talent community. Great recruiting, strategic recruiting is a talent pipeline. So let's say I didn't hire you because you didn't have enough experience. Well, why wouldn't I just keep in touch with you, say, hey, when you get one more year experience, how about we come on over? And so these people came in so close and met in some cases like literally the coin flip. Why wouldn't you keep in touch with them online with the talent community, kind of a club? They're special people. And when a job comes open, and you think they're now ready for it, you send them a note that says, you know, we'd consider your application again. So you don't let them go. You keep in touch with them. The same with boomerangs, people that leave to go to another company. Well, unfortunately, like LeBron, the best people leave. It just happens because they're in demand. But you keep in touch with them and say, someday you're going to come back to us, or someday you're going to work for us. And so that's what I call the talent community. Someday you're going to work for us. And maybe you chose not to this time. So maybe they dropped out of the hiring process. Maybe they got a better offer. But so they applied. That tells you something. They came close. Let's keep in touch with them. So both boomerangs and silver medalists are important. And if you look at it, one of the things I do is measure the quality of hire, the performance of the hire. So the number one is employee referral from your top performers, not from anyone, but top performers. But number two is probably boomerang. And number three is silver medalist.
I couldn't agree with you more. I find that especially now people are having to do more with less. And I hear the excuse, if you will, I just don't have time to stay in touch with people. And that's where you go, you know, shame on you, because you're absolutely right. It is about, I mean, you've worked so hard to develop that relationship. Why would you let it go?
Well, I'm a fan of collaborative hiring. No, the first thing I do is, this is a recruiting culture. Everybody recruits 24/7. Any questions? If you don't take that role, you can't work here. So you're constantly looking. Recruiters don't have time to scour the internet to go to professional meetings, but employees do. So you just say, look, just give me their names. With LinkedIn, I don't need much more. Give me the names of the people that you learn from that are smarter than you, that have better ideas, that improve on your ideas. Give me your mentor. All these people we keep track of, but it might be that other employees keep track of them. It might be a robot keeps track of them, but they feel like they're wanted, that they're needed. And you just have to do that. These are not people looking for a job. So people call them passives, but they're not passive. They're just not looking for a job. Mm-hmm. So people not looking for a job won't join a job board or won't follow a job board. But if you say, let's learn more about nuclear physics, they'll join that talent community. So you keep that approach. Microsoft does it, so several other people do it. Keep in touch with them on professional interests, and then when they're ready, say, hey, we've got a job.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to work, some companies, Ralston, Purina comes to mind, they fill jobs before the jobs are technically even open,
mm-hmm.
because their pipeline is so strong. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want what I call panic, I'm sure you guys do it, panic sourcing. Oh my God, LeBron quit. What do we do? I mean, panic, scream and yell and look at every source. Why would you do that? So I don't hire what I call strangers. Strangers are people that lie on their resume, lie during the interview, could fool me because I only talked to them for 3 hours. They could fool me. But if one of my employees knows them, if you know we have a connection because they applied before, then the concern is much smaller, the odds of getting gypped. So most functions should, but don't, measure the hire failure rate. What percentage of new hires turn out to quit after a month, to be toxic employees, et cetera? If you measure that, you'll find that that only happens with strangers. If you live in a small town, references would be reliable because you're not going to lie to your best friend or your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
But when you live in Los Angeles and the law says you can't even tell if someone gave a reference, no, strangers lie to you. So one of my many principles of the Silicon Valley, don't hire strangers. Hire people that are customers. Hire people that have applied before. Hire people that your employees know and make referrals of. Those are the ones that turn out to be the best people, and they don't fool you.
You make a huge point about being, you know, an environment or really a culture of collaborative hiring, that everybody has to have that recruiting hat on. And, you know, I'm headquartered here in Phoenix, Arizona, and so we have predominantly small to medium-sized businesses. And to be able to reiterate that mantra, if you will, would be, you know, very beneficial. Okay, so let's move to your book, Stay Interviews and Other Powerful Retention Tools. So I was having dinner with a couple of friends the other day, and they're both C-level executives, and I was telling them about my upcoming conversation with you and asked them if they were familiar with stay interviews. And they, you know, have come out of large organizations, and they had never heard of stay interviews. And I would imagine, I know that you invented this, right, in the late 90s? And it's probably frustrating when you hear that people are still saying, I never heard of that. I hear that with recruitment research all the time.
Well, I don't find recruiters are familiar with the tools. So my specialty are tools. What is the best tool? And so it turns out I did invent it. So we were thinking, it's like, okay, people leave and exit interviews. Do they tell the truth? Of course not. So we need to do post-exit interviews. Let's wait 6 months and ask them why they really left. And the answer changes dramatically. But then I thought, but it's too late. both of these are too late. Why don't we ask them why they stay? So that's what we literally was called, why do they stay, now called the stay interview. It turns out it's literally the number one most effective. It's dirt cheap. It's only 1 hour. But you just sit down with people and say, Kathleen, you're a great employee. We really appreciate all you do. And we want to reinforce, we call them sticky factors. Why do you stay? And you say, why stay? Because I get to work with John. Who are they going to fire his ass? Maybe we shouldn't. Or you don't like working on Saturdays when we were going to make you. So by reinforcing the positive, you avoid the negative, which is very emotional. And you just say, why do you stay? Because it turns out, again, through research, people do not leave because they have a crummy job, because half the world has a crummy job. They leave because they have a crummy job and some nasty event, career-damaging event. My boss gave me a bad performance appraisal. They turned down my project. So what we found is that if you keep those sticky factors strong, I feel appreciated, I see the result of my work, that they won't quit when a bad event occurs, like their boss turning down a project. And so that's why stay interviews, literally the most effective, least costly, because it's personalized, because it's one-on-one. It starts with, we appreciate what you're doing, the number three factor in retention. We appreciate you. And then just to say, we want you to stay, is sometimes a surprise. And then it's, let's reinforce those positive factors.
So that's what the manager should do to prepare for that, to look at that. How about on the flip side, what should the employee do to prepare for that interview?
Well, the manager hopefully will tell them that we're not going to fire you, don't be afraid. Here's the purpose. But we just like to know more about you and why you stay. And employees are pretty good at that. But in some cases, you give them what we call a prompt. Like, well, if you don't know why you stay, here's why Mary stays. Here's other people stay. And so they go, oh, yeah, I do stay because of the no commuter I get to work with. I get to work with LeBron. Nothing else matters. And it turns out that after great work, great coworkers. So you just remind them, by the way, you get to work with LeBron every day. Wow, that's great. And if you left, you wouldn't get to work with LeBron. So it's simple marketing research. Let's find out this individual. And it has to be personalized. Almost all retention is across the board. So if you gave LeBron a raise, he wouldn't care. He wants a great player in order to win a championship. So once you find out through a stay interview what those factors are, you reinforce them, you're not only going to get longer tenure, going to get more productivity.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so simple, John. So as HR folks are putting a stay interview toolkit together, what are some of the things they should be including?
It starts out by saying thank you. Let them know that you know their work. You appreciate their work. You even know what it is. You know, you mentioned one of the projects or something like that. Next is you want to say, we want you to stay. I'm trying to be subtle here. You really make a difference. The team loves you, et cetera. Third is, what are your sticky factors? They list them. And then fourth is, what can we do to reinforce those? Once in a while, you ask, is there things we need to stop doing? I don't normally ask that, but others do. And they'll say, well, I don't want to fill out any reports. Okay. It's like broccoli. You know, you probably like the stems. You're crazy. It's the florets. But if you don't like the florets, and you want the stems, I'll find someone else to eat the florets, and I'll find someone else to do that work. So you don't do a stay interview with everyone. If someone's 65 and going to retire, you don't need to stay interview them. But you pick the jobs that really matter, the individuals that really perform, and you say, I'm going to do that once a year. But I've seen companies where it's done every quarter because the turnover is so high. And by the way, if I live in Northern California, my house burns down, as most of them do. I went from not caring about money to instantly caring about money. And if I have a relative with COVID, I now call about health care. So the other thing we learned through research is that the sticky factors change over time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. People become parents, and that is a whole different dynamic, right?
Well, especially with school systems. When you can't send your kid away, you don't really get a vote. You know, you have to do something, so remote work options become critical.
Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation, right?
Right. But it's an important one. It's like, you normally you say, well, you know, you should be dedicated to work, but in these cases, you can't be. And so you have to work around it. And if you offer remote work, it changes recruiting. So one, let's say there's a shortage of diverse women in your Phoenix area, but there aren't a shortage of diverse women in Africa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so if your jobs can be filled from anywhere, local geographic restrictions, in other words, limits on the amount of talent, go away.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem is that Google, who might not have an office in your town, can now recruit away your people because they can work remotely. So it changes the game dramatically in that almost everyone now fights against Amazon and Apple, and that's just a tough fight. So mm-hmm. you're going to get better. You get no choice because now no matter where you live in Oklahoma, Google can recruit your people away. They can work at home. They pay Google wages. And that's a hell of a battle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hang on for a moment, John. We have to take a break. But coming up in the second part of my conversation with Dr. John Sullivan, the globally recognized HR thought leader, John tells me why he's not a big fan of resumes.
LinkedIn profiles are actually more accurate because your colleagues see it. They know if you're lying. For your resume, most people don't see it. But it's factually true, 66% of resumes, not just kind of minor mistruths, actual lies.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.